2021 Advisory Committee meeting. Roll call.
All righty. When I call your name, please say here. David Mack.
Here.
Janet Brennan.
Here.
Jay Tufano called, Jeff Davis called, and Sandy Copeland called. Sandy Swint.
Here.
Scott Storm. Spencer Critchley.
Here.
We have a quorum.
You didn't call me.
Oh, I didn't.
You didn't call me.
Oh, wait. Oh, I'm sorry. This thing wasn't moved hard enough. I am so sorry. You're right. Alan Stroh.
Here.
Bob Smith.
Here.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Miss the S's.
I have a little electronic thing that doesn't always open up. Okay.
So we have a quorum. Are there changes to the agenda?
No, there aren't, Chair.
Yeah, I see some. Oh, not the agenda. I'm sorry. I'm ahead of myself here.
Now is the time for comments from the public on items not on the agenda. Are there any public comments? Seeing none, we will go on to accept the advisory committee meeting summary of February 4th. Are there any changes?
Yes, that's the one I was mistakenly saying there were changes. The minor nitpicky things. The annual 2020 engineering compliance activity data report that was included in our agenda package lists the agenda items, item 5, and that was actually public comment on that agenda. And that should have been item. See what item? Future engineering and. No, I'm trying to find it on here now. I had it. I should have marked it. That should have been item 8. Excuse me. And also, I noticed there's it's either a alien language or some kind of machine language was on mine. I don't know if the rest of you and the headers, minor thing, but I was just kind of wondering what that was about.
What you're looking at is the minutes from that meeting. And what happened is sometimes with the PDF, when it takes a document and translates it into PDF, that will happen. What those are actual pictures of the slides that were presented at the meeting.
Oh, I see.
And it is item number 8 on the summary of actions. So I am not quite sure what you're looking at.
You had included the agenda item itself, the annual engineering, and it was up at the top right, it was listed as agenda item number 5.
That's a header, and that was a carryover from the.
Okay,
it's a technical glitch in the PDF.
Yeah, it was like I said, it was just a nitpicky little item.
I apologize. Yeah, I should do better quality control when I PDF items.
Okay.
Are there any other comments? If not, we'll accept the minutes as submitted.
Got one comment, quickly. Is the link supposed to take you right to the Zoom? Because the links I'm getting don't. I have to type in the whole entire link.
You should hopefully get, and maybe I have your incorrect email. You should be receiving invitations to the webinar as a panelist prior to the meeting. We send them out 2 times prior to the meeting. So maybe what we need to do is double check your email to be
sure. I'm getting the emails. There is a link. It says join, link to join, but that never works. But when you send me the paper one, it's got, the link to meeting address, and I just have to type that whole thing in, not I can't handle okay. that.
Okay, I'm not sure what's going on, Scott. Webinar invitations are generated directly from the Zoom website. So, I'm not sure.
That's why I'm always 3 or 4 minutes late, because I'm sitting here struggling to.
Okay, that's interesting. I'll have to let them know that's happening.
Okay, no big deal. I just want to let you know. Thanks.
What are you using for the email app, Scott?
Could we finish the minute item?
Yeah, I guess so.
With no comments, we'll accept a summary of the last meeting as submitted. So now, other comments about how to access the meeting? All right, we will go on to the presentation on the AB 2766 funds report. I guess this is David Risby.
Yes, good afternoon. This is a report on our annual report that we do every year for our AB 2766 program, which funds motor vehicle emission reduction projects in the region. We fund the electric vehicle incentive program and some other infrastructure projects to reduce emissions from motor vehicles. And we have Alan Romero here to give you a presentation on the program.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chairperson Brennan and members of the committee. I'm going to need to share this file that I've got. Let's see, share screen. Let's pick that and hit share. How are we doing so far? Can you see that?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Perfect. Okay, we'll start the slideshow from the beginning. Once again, good afternoon. As my manager, David Frisby, mentioned, this is something that we do every year prior to the March board meeting. We present to the board staff recommendations for opening up the next fiscal year program, which would be fiscal year 21-22. Little bit of background on AB 2766, passed in 1990, then Assemblyman Byron Scherr. It authorizes air districts who participate in this program to collect a $4 DMV fee for all cars registered within the three counties. And we take those funds and we administer fund grant programs. We are mandated by the Health and Safety Code to do that. And it's been going on for some 30 years now. Typically what we've done over the years, the scope of this program has changed. We are under the last 4 years, we've divvied up the grant funds into two separate programs. One is called Clean Air Management and the other one is Clean Vehicle. Under the Clean Air Management program, we fund infrastructure projects that relieve congestion, but more importantly, result in significant NOx and ROG and PM2.5 reductions. The components of the Clean Air Management program include roundabout design and construction, the use of adaptive traffic signal control, and we added a third component last year called Advanced Clean Transportation, where we are incentivizing public agencies to electrify their fleets and replacing their diesel or gasoline vehicles. This year, we are going to propose to the board and also, once again, it's staff's pleasure to present this to the committee before we give it to the board for input and guidance as needed. But with the Clean Air Management Program, we're proposing to add, under Advanced Clean Transportation, the funding of private sector fleets and trying to get the medium to heavy duty fleet electrified in our three counties. This is a statewide effort with a lot of money on the table to do that. And for obvious reasons, a large percentage of NOx emission comes from the transportation sector in particular, the diesel medium to heavy duty fleets. The other program that we have under AB 2766, excuse me, a little too fast there, is the Clean Vehicle Program. The highlight of this program is the Light Duty Electric Vehicle Incentive Program for residents in the three counties. We also have a voucher replacement incentive program for public agencies. Recently, in the past few years, it hasn't been too attractive to any of our municipalities. I think, frankly, because of the amount of the voucher is a little out of their comfort zone to go ahead and replace. Back when we first started this program in fiscal year 14, our incentive for the voucher replacement amount was $25,000, and it was a big hit. We did 45 vehicles that year. To date, we've done 55 total agency electric vehicle replacements. Also under the electrical vehicle program, we want to propose to committee and board that we want to add the funding of electric bicycles. We currently run the program funding light duty, battery electric, and plug-in electric vehicles, as well as electric motorcycles. And the addition of the electric bicycles was we had garnered enough public comment about it that we decided to propose it. I wanted to kind of highlight to the board, the committee, excuse me, I don't know if you know much about this program, but we've, in funding these infrastructure projects under clean air management, we've done some pretty cool little deals. These are the most current projects that we've granted that are underway. The first one here being the city of Soledad, a roundabout project at East Street and Metz Road, buttresses up against the freeway. This project will be complete, hopefully August of this year. Also, in fiscal year 18-19, we funded the city of Salinas for their East Baranda Road roundabout project, $400,000 to do all of the design for four roundabouts at each of these locations that you can see on the slide. And this is part of a West Salinas development project. This is a big deal to do these four roundabouts. It's going to cost well in excess of $8 million. But this project, in terms of the design aspect, is completed using the funding that we gave to them. So this ought to be a really exciting project for the city. Next up, some of the other projects that we've done under clean air management, which we're really excited to do, is the use of adaptive traffic signal control. For those that members of the committee that aren't aware of this, if you look at any signalized intersection, anywhere you ever drive, you'll see a cabinet at one of the corners. Inside that cabinet is a computer, and typically a day timer, much like the ones you use for your sprinklers. And when they use these configurations, it's called time of day plans. And so they're very static. In other words, when the traffic engineer goes out there and establishes how long each of the segments of the signal will hold, it's predicated upon traffic volume. So obviously in the morning and in the afternoon, AM, PM peak traffic, they're going to set a time of day plan for those particular hours. And at the rest of that time during the day, it's on a static plan, it never changes. With the use of adaptive traffic signal control, this is really quite a recent innovation, probably in the last 6 years. The use of detection and the use of algorithms can now be installed on these same controllers that you see on the corners. And now you can use real-time analysis to either delay or extend or hold green or hold red, based upon what the detection system sees. So in that very strict sense, it is real time. So instead of being stuck trying to make, you're the one car in the queue and you really want to get through the intersection, and there's nobody else coming and you're wondering, why am I sitting here so long? It's because of that time of day plan. But with adaptive control, it sees you, it doesn't see any of the platoons coming, so it advances the green. A really fantastic system. The city of Monterey has received 5 grants starting with fiscal year 13-14 to date. And they have done, as you can see on this map, so you can see the legend there. The lines in blue are currently running adaptive control. That's a portion of Fremont, all of Del Monte, and Lighthouse Avenue. These are huge congested areas, especially during tourist season in the city of Monterey. And with the Scoot system, it's amazing how well that runs. With the other grants that are in progress, you can see those in the red. Foam Avenue is parallel to Lighthouse. And those are, this is how people get out of Cannery Row. Without adaptive control, it queues up, it gets congested. And anybody that's ever been in that traffic mess knows, why can't they do something? Well, adaptive control comes in handy there. The other leg that's in process is going to be Mooners Avenue and a little bit of Fremont. And then the most recent one that we've just granted is going to be Pacific Avenue, which runs all the way to the water, and Franklin Street, which comes from DLI into downtown to Lake Estero, Lake El Estero. Just wanted to quickly point out to the board the reason why the district likes to fund these projects is their annual emission reduction. Really, really amazing. Much, much more than a single electric vehicle or any other emission reduction type of project. You can see that from the very first adaptive control project in fiscal year 13-14 on Lighthouse Avenue, that was a 3.1 tons per year emission reduction. The next phase two was at 3.2, which was Del Monte and Fremont. We gave them the city some expansion money. They added more intersections on these two corridors. So these reds go away, they get incorporated, and now we're up at 10.8 tons per year on those two legs. It's amazing because the volume of traffic is so huge. The phase three project, Munders and Foam, will yield 7.8. We're not quite there yet, it's not completed. And the last one being Pacific Street and Franklin at 1.4. So really, really good emission reduction with these projects like that. Here's another example we've done with the city of Watsonville. These are actually have been in operation for several years now. The one in the orange segment is Freedom Boulevard in Maine that yielded 1.2 tons per year. And the green segment is Green Valley Road. And that calculated at 2.1 tons per year. And that we've actually done after project emission control calculations. And these are the numbers that come up. So another good project for the city of Watsonville. Over in Santa Cruz, we've got a really cool project that is involving a joint effort between the County of Santa Cruz and the City of Capitola. Those who you who know Capitola very well and have ever got stuck on 41st Avenue, it's been like that for years. It is the most congested leg probably in all of Santa Cruz County. So the two teamed up. The county owns the properties along Soquel Drive. They're going to install the same system that the city of Capitola will install on 41st Avenue. I want to point out that the power of doing that, if we go back to the Monterey project with five corridors, all with Scoot, is that all of those intersections can now talk to each other. It's very, very, very powerful function of adaptive control, because if you're sitting at a segment that's several miles away, and all of those segments are under control, each of those systems can talk to each other. The advantage to that is when there's a large event, when you know that you get queued up in traffic as intersections load up, it keeps everything moving as quickly as possible. So these are very powerful systems, and this one will be a welcome one for the city of Capitola. And then the other component of the Clean Air Management Program is adaptive clean transportation. And we kicked this off in fiscal year 18-19 with a project from the city of Santa Cruz. They wanted to replace their CNG beach trolley, which runs from downtown Santa Cruz to the wharf. They wanted to replace them with two electric versions of that. We welcome that opportunity to partner with them to do that. So they purchased two class five electric vehicles from Phoenix Motors, and they just received the last one last year. These are really kind of cool. They're wheelchair adaptable. You can see the wheelchair ramp in the back. They look nice and comfortable, and they're ready to go. Unfortunately, COVID has kept the summer trolley at bay. And so we're hoping, and so is the city, that come this summer, the trolley will be operational again, and they'll get to use electric vehicles instead of CNG. Also, another big project that we've done with MST here in Monterey County is to fund two of, we've funded three. The first one is operational. It's a BYD 38 passenger. These are full passenger Gillig's, and they expect delivery of two of them in 2021. We've funded both of these as well in conjunction with some Federal Highway Administration funding as well. So we're pretty excited about when those show up. And then lastly, another good example, last 2 years ago, fiscal year 20, we awarded the city of Salinas the funding to purchase 3 electric Class 6 trucks from Phoenix Motors. That includes 2 flatbeds, as you see in the picture. That is an actual picture of a Phoenix Motor flatbed electric truck, and then 1 box truck up above. And these will be due in 2021 as well. Very exciting for the city of Salinas. And then lastly, our EVIP, which has been ongoing now. This is we've just completed our 5th year of operation of this program. For the light duty sector, as more and more electric vehicles come to the market, we're finding a great participation. This is obviously a statewide effort as well as at the local air district level. And just to give you an idea of how we've done, this is a chart showing the number of incentives. In other words, this represents electric vehicles that are now on the road starting with fiscal year 17. And the grand total is 1,360. If you'll note a little trend here that you see these numbers go up and then it comes down. And there's a reason behind that. And that's because of the amount of funding that we actually cap. So the very first year we offered $2,500 for an all electric vehicle. And then in the succeeding 3 years, we dropped that number down sequentially. So from 25 all the way down to 1,000 in fiscal year 2019-20, and then back up again to 2,000 in fiscal year 21. So you can see the correlation. Obviously, the less funding you have, the more participants can get involved. And once you take that up to a higher amount, the number of participants will start to go down. So that's an interesting analysis, because it helps you try to find a sweet spot. So what gets people to apply or purchase an electric vehicle based on incentives? Because without the incentives, it's going to be kind of tough, because the electric car still has yet to reach parity with a conventional gas car. So we're hoping that day will come soon. The cost of batteries is coming down dramatically, and we think that we're close. So with that, this is what staff is going to recommend for funding levels. We have $1.2 million scheduled for clean air management and $500,000 for the clean vehicle program. I think I skipped a chart. No, I didn't. That's right there. Okay, sorry. So so each of these components of each of these programs, these are what we typically go to the board with our recommendations. So for roundabout design and construction, $400,000 per project. ATSC, same thing, $400,000. And for advanced clean transport, we are looking at $400,000 for a public agency project, and $200,000 proposed program addition for the private sector. This year for clean vehicle program, we've typically operated at $400,000. We want to up that to $500,000. And looking at the EVIP for the residents, we thought we would start it back to that magic sweet spot at $1,000 for a light duty BEV, $500 for a motorcycle, which is a little bit more than last year. You can see those in red. And then for the proposed program addition of e-bikes, we're looking at perhaps $300 per incentive. And one thing to point out to the committee is this is how we allocate funding with AB 2766 monies, because these are local DMV fees. This is allocated based on population. So if you break down the populations between the 3 counties, Monterey County garners the most at 57%, Santa Cruz getting 35%, with the remaining 8% going to San Benito County. And that's pretty much the program that we run every year. What we would really appreciate from the advisory committee is any input and guidance. The 4 bullets to kind of reflect on is your comments or guidance on the addition of the private fleet to the EV funding, also the increased allocation for the EVIP to $500, also addition of e-bicycles to the incentive for EVIP, and then lastly, all of the funding caps for both of the programs. So with that, I would like to open it up to the committee.
Are there questions from committee members?
Hello, Alan. I've got a question regarding the electric bikes. What are they replacing that currently generates air pollution? It seems like we're replacing something that's human powered with something electric powered.
That's a very, very good point. So one of the challenges in adding an e-bike incentive to a conventional automobile incentive program is exactly that. it would seem intuitively that that's exactly what you're doing. You're just putting an e-bike and replacing it with your pedal bike. So that's something that would be very challenging to be able to try to measure emission reduction based on that.
You would think that somebody that was using an electric bike is not somebody who wants to be riding a manual bicycle. It's somebody who would rather be driving a car, correct? That would, in my thought, if I'm riding an electric bicycle, I'm someone that would normally be driving a car, correct?
I think that's a good assumption to make. There are probably a wide variety of assumptions to make here in trying to incentivize e-bicycles. At this point in time, they're just popular because they're cool. I mean, if you walk the Monterey Coastal Trail here in Monterey, in the city of Monterey, this plethora of e-bikes are starting to just show up, and it's not something that's been ongoing. E-bikes have been around a while, but as of late, they're becoming very, very popular.
I'm just assuming, like most people I know that ride bicycles, it's for exercise, right? Yeah. I mean, that's what I mean by like you're just replacing a vehicle.
Right.
In that way.
Most of the current design features of the e-bike is that you pedal on flat road when, you know, you're not really exerting yourself too much. And then if you need a little assist going uphill or a grade, or maybe you need to get there really quick, because I think that they're faster than the pedaling version of the bike, then those features are designed in.
I see.
Yeah, they probably weren't around back then in the very first iteration of e-bikes, especially with the battery, with the limitation of the battery range.
But you're saying we have no data on what they'd be replacing. For example, where I live out on the outskirts of Salinas, I see people on bikes that have gas-powered engines on them. And, you know, in that you would be replacing a gas engine. But there's no data on what these things are intended to replace. There's no nobody's done any research to show what happens. It's just not known.
Absolutely. I mean, as I said before, as the design and the battery improvements have come forward with technology, and now in entrepreneurial bicycle manufacturers saying, let's make an e-bike and sell it. If you look at what's out in the market right now, there's more than a handful of e-bikes that you could buy and choose from, each with different design aspects, some with longer range, some are designed strictly for mountain terrain. But your point is very well taken. There's, at this point in time, it's too early in the game to come up with any real metrics that says, hey, what did I replace? What emission reduction did we really gain?
Well, it seems as though that
Spencer had his hand raised some time ago. Let's finish the discussion on e-bikes, and then Spencer, you can ask.
Well, it was just a question. It was a question about the. I was just raising my hand to ask a question about the e-bikes.
Thank you, Alan. Go ahead, Alan.
All right. I'm just following up on Bob. I mean, I had the same question initially, and it seems like this is very muddy. Do you think it's premature to include the addition of e-bikes with so little data? I mean, it doesn't seem like you have a good handle on who the target audience is, what it's going to do in terms of reducing air pollutants. It just seems really muddy. I got nothing against e-bikes, but it seems like they're more like a faddish recreational thing right now. Or as people like me are getting older, the baby boomers, maybe you need a little help up the hill. But it just seems why is the money going on this? I just have a feeling in the future you're going to get kind of nailed on the lack of focus with this proposal.
My comment on this is can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. I can.
Yes.
My comment is when the applicant files for a grant, the applicant will be providing information regarding how the EBAC will be used and will it replace vehicle trips. So that is a way to begin to develop data, assuming that all the information is accurate. So it seems to me that that is a beginning point in developing a database for this.
I don't know if that develops a database. I think what you need to do is figure out what the parameters of that such a program would be and who would fit into such a program based on what your goals are. I think you have to establish a goal for a program like this ahead of time. And then as people apply, do they fit into those goals based on their proposed usage of an e-bike? I mean,
I think we're saying the same thing.
It doesn't seem like there's any goals, objectives, or anything established ahead of time for this program to give it some focus. And that's all I'm saying is going to be, it might be a hard sell to the next group you go to, like the board or something. I don't know. But, you know, without having some, have kind of honing in on what your goals are for the program in the first place.
I have a suggestion along these lines.
Spencer?
And that would be to look, if we're looking at these various proposals, if you look at them as equivalent to an investment portfolio and you set up a set of criteria for the return you're expecting for the investment. And that would help you define the data space basically that you want that portfolio to function in. So I agree, it seems a little, if there's no data about the benefit of electric bicycles, then it's hard to know what the return on that investment would be, right? Whereas it seems like there's excellent data on the return from the roundabouts and the other programs that Alan showed us earlier. I thought that was really exciting to be able to see the tons per year. And it'd be great to know what the cost benefit is for each one of these investments. I know sometimes you have to do judgment calls because the data can't be perfect, but to the extent that you do have usable data, then you can say, we think that by balancing our portfolio with $500,000 here, $400,000 there, et cetera, we expect to get these kinds of returns in terms of emissions reductions, et cetera, on the way back. And then I think that helps decision makers as well. If there is an area like e-bikes, for example, where the data doesn't exist maybe, or it's very incomplete, you can identify that and say, this one, it's, you know, we just have anecdotal evidence so far. And so we're arguing for an investment of this size in part as a pilot project. And we expect that one of the yields from this investment would be better data. So that's my suggestion for that. And then as this is pure gut about e-bikes, and we would want data rather than gut. But my gut would be that people, I think somebody else said this earlier, people who ride bicycles, you know, they probably are doing it to a large extent for the exercise as well as the environmental benefit. And a bicycle is really not very practical if you have a long ride or uphill or any of that stuff. You get to work sweaty, et cetera. You can't carry enough cargo if you're shopping. So I would expect, just based on gut, that e-bikes probably aren't going to replace bicycle use for bicycle fans. They're more likely to nudge people out of their cars maybe for short trips and or people who can no longer ride a bike or that sort of thing. But again, be great to know what the actual impact would be based on real data.
If I could, Janet, sorry, if I could just speak to Spencer. Uh-oh, muted. Can you hear me? Okay, the one thing that we do for these clean air management programs, which makes them so, for us, we can rest pretty, I wouldn't say rest easily, but we do a calculation, not just tons per year, but we also look, we have a cost effectiveness value that is expressed in dollars per ton of emission reduction. So
we
have a target of $20,000 per ton, and typically these projects will fall well underneath that. And it's because of all of the metrics, the variables that go into the calculation equation, that when we recommend to the board funding a project, it's based upon two things: cost effectiveness and annual tons of emission reduction. So
Great.
Thank you for that, bringing that to to, because you can't, we can't do that with e-bikes yet. We can't even do it with electric vehicle incentives for light duty vehicle. In other words, if you apply for, you know, $2,000 to buy a Tesla Model S, and that's all great, but you still have your, you know, your Highlander or your long range gas car in the garage when you go to Disneyland, that's a whole different story. So yeah, there's a lot to this. There's a lot of variables to it. I think more importantly, the one thing about electric vehicles is that they're zero emission.
And, so it seems to me the suggestion from Spencer and Alan is that you establish criteria for the grant application for e-bikes to make sure that the applicants fall within the criteria. Is that a good summary of your recommendation, Alan and Spencer?
Yeah, although I thought Spencer was right.
Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah.
What I was saying was that, but also the cost benefit, and Alan Romero is saying that the data doesn't really exist yet on cost benefit, but and it sounds like it does for some of these other measures. So that answers my question. Basically, obviously the staff are well aware of the value of that kind of data and will get it as soon as it's available, I assume.
Other comments on there's some questions here. Addition of private fleet medium to heavy duty EV funding and increased allocation to 500K for EVIP, addition of e-bike incentive funding and individual project funding caps for both programs. Are there comments on any of those four items other than we've already done the e-bike?
Well, Madam Chair, if I may, you know, the had my hand up here for a while, but on the e-bike issue, everything we've heard is something we've already discussed. It's just that we've had a lot of feedback from the public and some board members thinking that it was good to have an e-bike incentive. So not only should you comment on that, but another area is, you know, the $300 that we came up with for an incentive was sort of out of the mid of the air too. So that gets to our funding caps for both programs. You know, we could start off at a lower amount if you thought that would be a safer bet or if you wanted to make comments along those lines. The same goes for increasing allocations for the EVIP program to 500K a year and so forth. So not just if it makes sense to add these programs, but also think in light of whether or not the funding levels are appropriate. Thank you.
If I could
have a question regarding the addition of private fleet funding. Is that because we're running out of public funding for public fleets?
Rich, you want me to take that?
Yeah, go ahead and I can add if you miss it.
The problem with public agency fleets is that they're so restrictive in what they would actually electrify, whereas with a private sector fleet owner, it might be a fleet owner with a class 5 or class 6, which is a vehicle that's under 14,000 GVWR. And if maybe he's delivering flowers or groceries or anything that involves delivery, making short runs throughout the day, could easily take advantage of a program like this wanting to electrify. The agency fleets typically, like take for example, the city of Santa Cruz, we just gave them $400,000 to buy a class 8, that's over 30,000 pounds GVWR. It's a refuse collector. And so it's pretty specific and very challenging because of what's available in the marketplace today. So the class 8 side of the heavy duty transportation space, there aren't a whole lot of available products. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, class 5, class 6, there are. And so, that's where you'll find these, and we're not talking about funding Amazon or Google or a UPS. We're really trying to look at focusing small fleet owners, especially those that serve disadvantaged communities.
So do your criteria limit the applicant for funding in this category?
Well, this it would be new for us to do this under 2766. We currently have with funding from ARB under the Community Air Protection Program, where we're specifically using dollars, and it's a very prescriptive program, by the way, to fund medium to heavy duty fleets in that serve disadvantaged or low income areas. And so we've got two venues to do this, one being very prescriptive, which is CAP, and the other one being less restrictive, because anyone that's not serving a disadvantaged community should have, we would think, an equal opportunity to get incentive funding for electrification. I hope that answered your question.
Other questions?
I had a suggestion for this kind of presentation, maybe just another slide or so showing some of the logic that you already have. This kind of extends from Richard's comment just a moment ago. So that when the question to folks like us or to the board is, how much should we devote to e-bikes or to this or that, you know, some kind of logic that helps to contextualize that so that it's not kind of, you know, subjective. Well, 300 seems a little high, you know, 100 seems a little low, because I don't really know, you know, so a little bit of the same kind of cost benefit stuff. Perhaps even, you know, in the case of an e-bike, it's not a very big grant. Maybe some of the data support for that would be something along the lines of the likely center of the bell curve on income for somebody who would be taking advantage of that, and therefore what kind of difference that would make to their purchase decision. So just a suggestion for that.
Well, Spencer, you bring up a good point. Like for instance, the e-bike program, is it individuals you'd want to target? You're already talking about governmental agencies, cities not participating as much as they have. Would an e-bike program work, like for instance, if your criteria was to close off streets in high tourist areas like Monterey to only pedestrian and e-bikes, and then maybe the city would either bring in a company that provides e-bikes where you wouldn't need to give a incentive necessarily, or if the city wanted to provide the e-bikes for alternatives to those that don't walk easily, or other type of e-vehicles that would be safe to use in a non-vehicle environment, that way people wouldn't be running around like in high tourist areas, you know, in their vehicles. And they park at some central thing. But what I'm getting at is I think you need a broader look at why you would want to do this, just as you were discussing, either so you get the most bang for the buck.
Mm-hmm. Other comments? So do we want to have a motion regarding any of the comments made?
Sorry, Janet, I do have a question. And maybe because I'm trying to multitask, but is this grant funding or allocation of funds available for any kind of e-bike? Or is it just a commuter e-bike? I mean, because somebody said earlier that there's many kinds of e-bikes, and I apologize if this was answered earlier and I just missed it. But I mean, for example, could somebody use this to buy like a mountain bike e-bike? I'm not advocating for that, but that would be a potential loophole, because if the intent is to offset some carbon emissions and other transportation issues, then that wouldn't necessarily meet the intent of the program.
David, I was the one who made the comment that as of recently, there are a lot of different e-bike manufacturers that are offering product, including electric mountain bikes that are specifically tailored, light frame, heavy duty suspension, all the good stuff that you want on a mountain bike. We typically would, and we've always remained, whenever it comes to manufacturers, we've always remained vendor neutral. So we would probably not consider someone making their own e-bike out of an old bike eligible for funding. So it would have to be something that obviously is new and manufacturable if we were to do something like this in our EBIT program.
But I think that's a good comment, David. And I think we could work that into our requirements that it be a commuter bike with the sole purpose of displacing a motor vehicle, gas-powered motor vehicle, or fossil fuel-driven So
yeah, I mean, I think that was the point of my question. If somebody applied for the program and they were simply going to buy a mountain bike, that wouldn't necessarily be what we're trying to accomplish.
That's exactly right. So thank you for the comments. I just like want to reiterate that, you know, we're sort of going off of the feedback we've gotten from several public members and a board member. So we're trying to incorporate that and take in the best ideas we can. You'll also notice that those aren't the private fleet and the e-bikes are not significant portions of the budget with respect to the overall amount. So it's not like we're switching gears radically here, but you know, I'm torn with the private fleet too, but I think Alan makes some really good points, and it would be nice to help those that, especially in disadvantaged communities, be able to drive less polluting vehicles with lower costs of operation.
Yeah, and it could be argued that it's a private subsidy to individuals who are applying for the EV grants. Is there an income test, by the way, now that that comes up for private citizens looking for a grant?
The only income test is if they want to be low income qualified, which actually doubles the incentive amount. So anybody could get a vehicle, but we follow California, their CVRP, which is their electric vehicle program. And it used to be that you could get an incentive amount for Tesla S. That's no longer the case because those are considered a little too expensive. So the program has been modified and is pretty dynamic to address those cars that are sort of for the uber wealthy. So that's sort of taking care of that segment of the market. So you can't go buy a Karma or some exotic electric vehicle. It's more for the mass produced right. type of electric car. So, and we're relying on the state to sort of be the leader. We do also use Central Coast Community Energy Services for evaluating the income qualifications for the applicants.
Oh, good.
Are there other comments or questions? Staff, do you have enough of a response from the committee, or are you looking for a motion? Or
I think we'll take back your comments in total to the board. Okay. we'll summarize them, but thank you very much. I think that's been helpful.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. All right, if there is we have no public members present, right? Okay, let's go on to the air pollution control officer report.
Okay, so thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few things regarding our February 17th board meeting. Oh, I think I put an extra zero in there. We had elections. Steve McShane was elected chair. This will be his third term in a row. Ryan Coonerty was vice chair, and this is his second term as vice chair. And then we have a new board member who's actually returning to the agency. That's Sam Story, who's with the city of Capitola. He previously was on the board through, I think, 2007 through 2014. And he brings a wealth of experience, especially in budgetary and fiscal matters. So it's great to have him back. He's gonna be on our budget personnel nominating committee. Board also received a report on marina odor situation. We have a confluence of sources in the marine area that are contributing to pretty bad odors, and all these sources range from a wastewater treatment plant to a landfill to composting operations and agriculture. And I think a safe bet is nobody can really say who has the predominant odor, but I think a safe bet is that they all probably contribute at one time or another to the odor situation out there, although the public is convinced that they have a particular source in mind. So we were trying to get input and direction from the board on just how far we were to take this. It looks like there's gonna be an odor attribution study that will be hopefully started by the landfill to look at the various sources and try to assign values for the odors. But we've been spending a lot of time as the de facto reservoir to collect complaints and receive complaints from the public. And then we end up distributing that information to the responsible local agencies, which we believe is first and foremost the County of Monterey. They have regulatory authority over landfills and composting operations. And then of course for agriculture as well. We have the authority over some of the operations at the landfill that produce emissions, but odors are very, very difficult to nail down. Folks have different sensitivities to odors. There's no machine that can qualitatively assess a concentration. So we're really in uncharted waters here too. And so we were looking for direction from the board. So it looks like we're gonna continue on in an advisory and consultative and collaborative fashion with all the entities, including the City of Marina. We will participate on the study design and selection of a consultant to do an odor attribution study. And we're gonna still be collecting information from complainants regarding odors in the Marina area. So that's where that fell out. I just was getting a little confused because this is something we don't get any revenue for. And I was very concerned that it was starting to put a strain on our resources. Similar to what you received last time, the board received the reports on our compliance and engineering activities, as well as air monitoring for calendar year 2020. In engineering, I just let the board know that we're resuming our in-person physically distanced inspections, still complying with stay-at-home order. And that's most of our inspection staff is doing that now. We're also been very much on the front lines with the California Air Resources Board and their criteria and toxics reporting regulation. This is going to be a huge impact on local businesses starting in 2025. This is going to require them not to only inventory criteria pollutant emissions, but also toxic emissions, and that's for sources that generate 10 tons or more per year. So we've been very much involved helping design that program and commenting extensively on ARB's rule. We're also moving forward with our implementation of our new database, which is Acela. We're transferring a lot of our information as our previous database, TrackIt. And so we've been having trainings and it looks like it's proceeding along really nicely, and that will bring us into the future with a really nice database management system. We're also currently in planning and air monitoring, running our change out program for wood stoves. Similar to motor vehicles, we're offering folks $1,500. And then if you have
taking everything
qualifications, you can receive an additional $2,000. So this is open to everybody in the district. I know, David, you were interested in that previous, Mr. Mack. So we're running out of funds and we don't have any state funds for the program.
Yeah, we just had a discussion about electric bicycles.
We're also accepting applications for our diesel engine and equipment replacement program, which uses state grant funds for replacing high polluting diesel equipment and engines with cleaner burning models and devices. So that application ends on March 19th. This is a program where, for instance, Carl Moyer is under that umbrella. We've been helping to replace tractors and other types of ag equipment out on fields and diesel pumps with electric pumps, that sort of thing. In air monitoring, we just installed a new monitoring station in San Juan Bautista at the elementary school to measure PM10. And this was required due to federal regulations. We exceeded more than 80% of the national ambient air quality standard in October 2019. That's all it took for EPA to come in and say, you need another monitoring station in that area. And we think that was an anomaly. There was sort of a really weird meteorological phenomenon during that time, which may have transported a lot of additional dust into our district. We haven't seen it happen since, but because of the regulation, we had to install a new monitoring site. And then as was mentioned perhaps earlier, is we've run out of funds in record time for our EVIP program, that's Electric Vehicle Incentive Program. And we've got about 244 vehicles that were replaced. Six of those are for low income. We'd like to do better in the low income area. We essentially doubled the amount for low income resident, qualified residents. We used some of the money we had the previous year. So we actually spent down 500K, as I said, in about 6 months' time, which is pretty amazing. I think there was a mad rush at the end of the year. People had heard, or there was a rumor that somehow our program was going to crash or go out of existence. So we just had a lot of people coming in to get rebates or incentive monies. Also, with the Monterey, formerly Monterey Bay Community Power, there was a lot of concern of the public that our program was going to cease operation. And they lobbied, the public lobbied and interest groups lobbied 3CE, Central Coast Community Energy, to give us money to keep the program going for the rest of the year. Since that jurisdiction is now five counties, which includes Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo, they felt that it would be unfair to all the ratepayers throughout those five counties. So they decided to run their own program. So you will be able to get a vehicle incentive from the Air District as well as Monterey Bay Community Power, or what's now known as Central Coast Community Energy, at least in our three counties, Monterey, San Benito, and Santa Cruz. So they took our program and basically put their name on it, and they've got $700,000 available as of February 1st. And it was important to us, we don't care that they're running a program necessarily, but it was important to us that the programs not be confusing and not compete with one another. So these guys can stack it and add these programs together and get an additional benefit. So we think that's good, especially for the folks that are living in our three county regions. We do not anticipate that San Luis Obispo or Santa Barbara's air districts will be able to offer electric vehicle incentives like the Monterey Bay Air Resources District. So it's good, sort of good news, I guess, that we're gonna have additional incentives in this area for our citizens. Then lastly, we've been running a lot of programs on KSBW, KPIG, and KAZU about anything from burning to our incentive programs. We were checking into Nextdoor, which is sort of the new rage for communicating among neighborhoods and communities. Turns out that for us to start doing any kind of meaningful advertisement or providing information, they wanted about $16,000 up front per year for us to participate. So what we'd rather do is spend that money on incentive programs. And we're going to encourage folks that participate in that platform that it doesn't cost you anything to say, hey, the air district's out there, they've got these grant programs, or don't burn tonight, or whatever the message may be. So you can really help us out by doing that if you're participating in that forum. So that concludes my report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I should just mention, in light of your first comments about the odor issue, that since the Waste Management District is one of my company's clients, I assume I shouldn't participate in that discussion.
Questions, Richard?
Yeah, you could part. We're not taking any action, so that was just an information item. If right. You have information to present, that would be helpful. I will say that I think the landfill and the wastewater treatment plant have just told us flat out that those things stink. They do stink. They cause odor. So it's more of a land use situation. You don't want to be building a lot of homes around landfills or wastewater treatment plants, but thank you for that comment.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of information, I assume folks probably know, the district is supporting a study to to come up with scientific data about where these odors are coming from so that it's less guesswork and it can be more data. And then they've committed to doing, you know, whatever is needed, that whatever is abiding by whatever the findings of that study are. So whatever it finds that their contribution is, they'll do whatever is possible to address that.
Any other comments?
Yeah, I had a comment following up on the previous discussion. A number of years ago, when I was still director of environmental health for the county of Monterey, we did a flyover principally in the area over Prunedale. And what we were shocked because we were getting all these odor complaints also, and we assumed it was coming from a site there that like coyote and that sort of thing. But it turns out that a number of the properties were storing their garbage in their backyards. And literally there were backyard 1 acre, 2 acre properties that were completely filled with garbage up to 5-6 feet deep in some cases. And the odors, when we were able to pinpoint it through this flyover and photography we did from the air, we were able to pinpoint those sites, and we were actually able to run down some of the odors that we didn't expect. I'm not asking you to borrow more trouble, Richard, but sometimes people don't behave the way they should.
Understood.
Other comments? If not, are there recommendations for future agenda items? Seeing none, I have no comments. Are there comments from committee members?
I think there's somebody in the public who has a comment about a couple of things if we get there.
There's a comment from the public, is that what you said?
Yeah, there's a gentleman, Brian, who asked if he could make a comment in the chat.
He was asking if he could make a comment on the APCO report. I'll leave that to the chair.
So Brian McCarthy would like a comment on the odor issue, is that correct?
Yes.
Baby?
Yes.
It's her PDSA, her little pet.
So Brian, do you want to comment?
I can unmute him if you'd like.
That's fine.
Okay, let me do that here. Okay, I think I asked him to unmute. Let me try it again.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
May I make some brief comments?
Yes.
Thank you so much. Sorry, I've been in and out, so I apologize if I kind of missed the ball on this one. I actually hadn't planned on making comments, but after hearing the oral report specifically about the odor issue, I just wanted to, one, introduce myself. My name is Brian McCarthy. I'm a resident of Marina. I'm also happen to be on the Planning Commission in Marina. And I've been heavily involved in this odor issue for years and years and years. And so first I wanna thank MBARD for, in fact, fielding these complaints that I personally agree MBARD does not have jurisdiction over. And yet MBARD has graciously fielded many of these complaints and really helped us as members of the public that are suffering from this environmental justice issue kind of track down the primary source of the odors. Which, as was mentioned, indeed, there are multiple sources of odor, of course, that is absolutely true. But it is also true that the public is, in fact, convinced there's a predominant source of the odor, and that is the compost operation out there at the landfill. In particular, the composting of food waste, which under Senate Bill, I think the number is 1833, is only going to increase in the years to come. The operation management practices, in fact, are so bad out there that about a month ago that the compost piles spontaneously combusted, requiring fire aid from multiple jurisdictions and taking those fire resources away from those jurisdictions. So again, as citizens, myself and a group of people are very confident where the source of the orders are coming from. We also agree MBARD does not necessarily have legal jurisdiction over them, but we, either way, we appreciate the effort and anything that's willing to be done from MBARD's perspective and helping convince others, or as some mentioned, scientifically pointing to the source of these odors. So I'm gonna keep it relatively short, but I do wanna, again, just introduce myself. And certainly if anyone wants to reach out to me to learn some of the information that we've shared over the, or learned over the years, you know, I'm certainly happy to do that. It's really a burden for a lot of the residents in Marina. Fortunately, it's very seasonal and driven by wind direction and other atmospheric conditions. And so we don't suffer all the time, but when we do, it is bad. It is a health concern, among other things. So I appreciate the time, and I'll keep it at that for now. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Are there any other comments? If not, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you for being here. See you next month or the next meeting.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.